Welcome to the Accelerating Operational Performance Podcast. I'm Greg Schenkel, President of Unique Training and Development and Frontline Leadership Systems. And our goal here, of course, is to achieve three things plus bonus material. One is to help you accelerate some of the initiatives and projects you're working on to make your business better. Also to help you with your personal growth and development and just get things done with less stress. So today, I'm happy to introduce my guest who I've known for close to 20 years. Both Stuart and I were members of the Canadian Association of Family Enterprise, which is now called FEX. And also, we've been members of a professional speaking association together at the same time. We've done some joint presentations together. He's someone I really respect. So let me introduce him properly. Today, we're joined by Stuart Morley from the beautiful Muskoka region of Canada. He is a seasoned business professional with an MBA and a passion for driving growth. With his unique blend of academic experience and real-world experience, Stuart brings a fresh perspective to the table. His master classes, Scale Up, Transform, and Fund Manager offer immersive experiences that help participants achieve crucial mind shifts. These programs are designed to empower teams to set direction and implement strategies effectively. So let's tap into the insights and explore the latest trends in business strategy, innovation, and more. Stuart, welcome to the show.
Greg, thank you. Always a delight to chat to you.
Yes. Yeah, actually, I was thinking that we have intersected many times, including having referred you to some clients that do strategic business planning, something that we don't do, something that you do and specialize in. So I'm curious, Stuart, if you can give our listeners and viewers just a sense of some of the journey that you've taken sort of to get where you are today.
Certainly, Greg. So I grew up in Zimbabwe, went to university in South Africa, was with the Deloitte Empire there, transferred to Toronto in the mid-80s, and left them in 89 when and went into investment banking, mostly doing turnarounds. Then in 96, moved to Muskoka to raise my family, turned the cottage into home concept. That was the time when email and cell phones started. Ran my consulting business from there, got involved a lot in the family business world, helping with succession, got involved for 4 or 5 years specializing in management buyouts, and then during COVID started to specialize in the masterclasses. So that's sort of been the quick overview of my journey.
Yeah, and we're going to dig into some of those masterclasses because I think the audience would be fascinated to know how you can simulate an accelerated process from startup to either exit or to acquisition or IPO. One of the things that I'm interested in, and I'm wondering when this happened for you, is usually in someone's career, at first, there really is no true confidence in what you're doing because, you know, you might have some education, but you're really kind of finding your way through your career. And I'm wondering, is there a moment that, or maybe a certain time frame that you can think of where things started to click and you knew that you had a unique ability or the ability to do things well? I'm just curious, when did you feel like you came into your own in terms of your confidence?
Oh, I'm still working on that. I'm still wanting to decide what I'm going to do when I grow up. I guess there were a couple of moments of different perspectives. When growing up in Zimbabwe, I studied who was making money. And it was the rich farmers, the tobacco farmers in those days. And so I wanted to become study something in the agricultural sphere. And to go to university in agriculture in those days, you needed sciences and chemistries and, you know, physics and all that kind of stuff, which was not my forte. I was more of a geography, English kind of guy. And my aptitude test said to me, look, you know, you really should follow your father and become an accountant and do finance. And I went, oh, that's boring. I was determined to get into university and do an agriculture degree, even though my sciences were really poor. And I was just so damn adamant that nearly didn't make it, but actually managed to scrape through with an agricultural economics degree. So that was sort of flying in the face of conventional wisdom at the time. And it was like I was determined I was going to become a farmer and make a lot of money and unfortunately, during that four-year degree, I realized that most of the farmers were, as they say, acid rich and cash poor. And I thought, this is not much fun. But I still finished that. So that was sort of, you know, flying against all the conventional wisdom and actually surviving coming out the other end. I think that was when I thought, well, you know, you got to make up your own mind what you really want to do.
Right. So when you then go on your career journey, you end up doing your MBA, of course. I'm just wondering, when did you sort of shift into your focus? But it sounds like you were already thinking about what businesses made money, cash money. When did you get interested in either strategy or sort of how management made decisions around the running of their companies?
Right. So when I realized the agricultural degree was not doing it for me, I spoke to one of the lecturers and he said, if you really want to understand business, you need to do an MBA. And at the time I had no business experience, but again, they mostly wanted MBAs students to have at least 5 years business education before you could get in. And I applied to Cape Town, which was a special one-year program for MBA back then. And again, defied, you know, the audience that says, look, you have no experience. Why should we let you in? You know, and being cheeky, saying, well, do you want me to go and become an auditor for 3 years and then come back and do this stuff? Like, and eventually they took me on. So there were three of us that were very young to bring the average age down because they have a few older folks. And so during that course, I suddenly realized that in the programs that the MBA were running, and you work in groups when you're doing case studies and whatnot, I had an instinct for the strategy piece. It seemed to come easy. And some of the corporate finance concepts came to me more easily than others. And I thought, there's something here. And later when I joined Deloitte, they would always use me in a special problem. So they would parachute me in when they couldn't figure out a solution to a problem. And I just had that ability to join the dots at a high level. I was pretty useless at anything else, the consulting gig, but for some reason they could use me. Can I give you an example?
Yeah, please.
So they had a project where they had a holding group that owned a bank that mostly specialized in leasing stuff, and they owned a trust company that did mostly wealth management for high net worth individuals. And they had two presidents or managing directors, they call them, reporting each to a board. And then that board reported to a higher board. And there was this huge fight between the three boards because they didn't have the same directors on all three boards. And you had two managing directors, you know, each with a different reason why the more money should go into growing their side of the business than the other. And this battle was going on and on and on. And the partner called me and he took me through and he said, what the hell's the story here? And I remember listening to him for an hour. I went for a walk. I came back and I said, I think I know the answer. The answer isn't which one are you going to pick as the managing director or president. The answer is make the board members all the same on all three boards. And so we went into the meeting and to do the presentation. I was sitting there and my partner said, okay, here's our recommendation as consultants. We're not going to tell you which one of these guys to pick. We're going to tell you that you have to have all the board members the same on all three boards. And the chairman asked us to leave the room, but sit outside the door. And for the next 2 hours, we heard yelling and screaming and shouting through the door. And eventually the chairman came out and said, that was the best decision ever. And we're going to do it. Thank you. Send us a bill. So it was one of those kind of quick, and I don't know why I said it. It's just, I just had that kind of feeling. The problem's usually not the problem, I guess, is something.
Well, let's actually dig in a little deeper on that. And, you know, one of the reasons I referred you to one of our clients for some strategy work and business strategy planning is because I don't really think of myself as a particular strategic thinker. I always think of myself as a tactical thinker. I'm wondering if you could just help clarify from your mind, what is strategy work really about for a company? And either why is it important or what's the methodology that you think of in terms of trying to help a company with its strategy?
Yes, so the difficulty I had was that if you read all the books on strategy, most of them are, and business planning, it's this long, ponderous process and lots of written documents and lots of PowerPoints and secret plans locked in cupboards and it's executives, sitting on it. What I had discovered in my journey was strategy is often the opposite of that. It's about what's the real problem? The problem is not the problem. And in the world we have now, the people sitting around the boardroom table are the management. In the old days, we assumed they had all the knowledge they needed to make the strategic decisions. That's not the case anymore. In most companies now, the knowledge is spread throughout the organization. But how can you, if you've got an organization of hundreds of people, how do you involve hundreds of people in the strategy? Because all of them have, many of them have key pieces of information that are very useful. Somebody who's been talking to customers has an insight. Somebody on the production line has an insight. There are so many things going on in these companies. And so one of the difficulties is to simplify things, but not make it simplify in the wrong direction. So in my journey, I developed a one-page strategy tool. And I took away vision and mission and all those things that confuse people. And I really just try to focus on the one thing from which you can then do not more than three things to fix that. And of those three things, not more than three things to fix that. I had a little simple kind of format. And I'd force people to think through that. And it was so simple, but so powerful. And also, when you introduced me to that company, one of the opportunities I said to them, look, this is no good. You don't know enough at the board level. I need to go talk to your customers because as a stranger, they'll tell me things you don't know. They'll tell me things they won't even tell your salespeople. And I need to talk to your employees because they'll tell me things you don't know. And by allowing me to have that opportunity to get that information, then bringing that to set the scene, there was a huge aha moment in terms of some of the employee issues and a huge hamama. Aha moment in terms of the marketplace. In fact, this company, we identified a whole new marketplace that was in another part. They did business in Canada and the US, but most of their business in the US was mostly in the North Detroit kind of focus. And there was a whole bunch of potential customers down in the Georgia, Virginia area that they didn't even know, wasn't even on their radar screen. But it was again, what was the key question I asked that triggered that kind of information? So it's being able to cut through and what's the biggest problem we have to solve, right?
Right. So I'm curious because you've, in your journey, you've helped companies, family companies through their succession issues. You've advised companies on either how to get ready for sale or maybe on the purchasing side, how to make a good acquisition. I'm curious, is there any common theme that runs through all those potential scenarios that you've learned around strategy? And what ails companies or what causes them to either be tremendously successful or sometimes off track?
Yes, so what cemented that is when I went into the investment banking world in the 90s and did turnarounds. That was a whole new world because if you're really good at turnarounds, you often do the opposite of what a normal growth manager would do. And it sounds simple, but in many cases, companies that get into trouble, they make the same mistakes over and over again, expecting a different result. And they're reluctant to take the alternative path. So when you and I were consulting on some of the opportunities around pricing, one of the opportunities that I find when a company is in trouble is I go in and I see where they have pricing power. If they do, you can put up your prices 10 or 20% fairly quickly and not go out of business. And that can make a huge difference to a business. You could shrink a business and still be profitable if you can control and up your prices. And yet most companies are going to, oh, if I have my prices, it's the end of the world. I'll lose all my customers, et cetera. So it's some of those elements. Another element was incredible candor. So most companies, when things are not going well, the managers in hushed meetings and very quiet. When I would go into these companies and when they're in trouble, I would disclose to everybody, this is the problem. This is exactly the problem. This is what we have. And I would tap into all the talent at all levels to say, we're in this together to get out of it. Unless you all contribute, we're not going to get out of the hole.
So interesting to me that one of the things that has really given you an edge, even though it's such a basic thing, is just talking to people to find out what potentially the real story is. And I know when we're trying to even help frontline leaders become better decision makers and problem solvers, the defining of what the problem is part of the issue. And often the leaders just are lacking in the information. Now, many senior leaders make decisions with not having all the information. I remember that was a tenet of my business education when I went through in my undergrad business. It's like, you'll never have complete information, but what you want to do is to have enough information. And I guess what you're saying is a lot of companies spend a lot of time symptom solving because they're going from a narrow data set. They don't have a complete picture. And they're also reluctant sometimes to do what's right. Going back to pricing just for a minute, because, and again, for the audience's purpose, Stuart and I did a shared presentation for professional speakers, some consultants and coaches were in the room. And Stuart always has this like the great little illustration that he says, like, what is the world's most expensive hamburger or the most expensive handbag? And it's, of course, atrociously expensive and ridiculously expensive, and most people would agree you probably wouldn't buy that. But I think, Stuart, your illustration there is to say that price is this sort of, not arbitrary, but in some ways it is a bit arbitrary, and people's view of price is different. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Yes, so it hasn't happened often, but occasionally I've persuaded clients to actually have something that was a signature price. And that would create an incredible amount of discussion around why is this price, you know, the way it is, or why is this element very different? In other words, people don't automatically assume because the price is high, I'm not interested. They often are more interested to know. And part of the pricing issue is 20 or 30% of people want to pay the higher price if you can give them a good story. The problem is we get persuaded by the 60 or 70% that are only looking for the cheapest deal. And pricing, it can be a signature for many other things. One of the ones which we hadn't shared was one I'd come across in the UK, where this restaurant, it was a fairly high-end restaurant, was struggling to get business. And this, and so what they developed was they put their prices up 20%, but they gave you a dice, you know, rolling the dice like in a casino. And at the end of your meal, you roll the dice, and if you got a six, your next meal was free, which would be one in six. So it would be about a 16% discount, right? But this created a huge wave of new business of, I brought my friend who's a perfect gambler, who knows how to whisper to the dice. We're going to order a very expensive meal because if we win our next similar meal or a meal for this, you know. And so this created a huge momentum. And in fact, there was a story of these investment bankers from Chicago that made a special trip when they were going to the UK to do business to take a trip to this particular restaurant to try their luck at rolling the dice. So the price has all kinds of connotations. And I know with some of the most expensive pizza in the world, will that include being cooked by a chef and delivered by a plane? Right. You know, there's a whole story you can build around it. And it's that signal with the higher price that encourages people to, so tell me the story why.
Awesome. I still remember the advice you gave me. You may even remember it. I called you from Vancouver, Canada, and I was discussing this first major opportunity. And you actually just asked three simple questions. You said, what is the lowest amount that you'd prepared to do that work for? And then the thing that really blew my mind, even though I didn't have the guts to actually go this way, is you asked the question, what solution would actually solve the customer's problem? And recognize that if your lowest price is X, let's say $300 or something, somebody's interested in a solution that's 10 times that or $3,000. So I just wanted you to know that your words are so impactful that this conversation from all the way back, probably around 2009 or 2010, still bounces around in my mind. Right? So anyway, I just wanted to say thank you because it has helped us bring our pricing, I guess, closer to the value, and recognizing that customers in the end are trying to solve problems, and the price is only one thing that factors into that. They're really just trying to solve a problem, and if you can solve that problem, the price isn't sort of irrelevant, but it's less important than achieving the outcome. So thank you for that. I just wanted to say thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
Yeah.
So
go ahead.
If I could add to that, the 10 times story is a great one, not only in pricing, but I also say to people, look, if you wanted to go first class from Toronto to London, England, you know, it's probably a $10,000 price tag, you know, but if you hassle, you could probably get the same ticket on the plane for $1,000. Now, it's not the same seat and it's not the same whatever, but this 10 times thing is happening all over the place. It's not unique. And why can't it happen in your business? In every business, there's a room for a 10 times opportunity. Yeah. So thanks for reminding me of that.
I think one of the things that ties this in just in general with your strategy and helping companies is to understand that your existing belief system could either support where you're trying to get to or be working in opposite to that. Now, one of the things that you've been involved in lately is some business simulations, which helps sort of a fast-growing company walk through the kinds of challenges that they're going to face in their history, but do it very quickly. Could you tell us a little bit about those simulations and kind of the value that they bring to some of the companies that you work with?
Yes. So, for example, with ScaleUp, ScaleUp is a three-day masterclass simulation. And in ScaleUp, you have teams. You have ideally 4 to 6 teams of people who are founders, and they are competing against ideally 4 to 6 other teams. So you've got somewhere between 16 to 36 people participating. And the opportunity here is to educate you on how to grow your business, mainly from challenges from the real world. So you start out with a card which says, this is your business, now pitch why you should get money, right? And then you go through rounds and rounds of funding, and you will start to realize that you may get a great deal on your first round of funding, but it may hurt you on your second round of funding. So suddenly you're starting to realize as a founder that if you try and overvalue your company this round, it's going to hurt you on the next round. You're also going to start to realize how much you get diluted as you bring more investors in. And if you get too diluted, what's the incentive to stay with your business? And then you've got interruptions where there's team disputes and issues that happen, classic founder owner issues. And then there's when you compete against the other teams and when do you cooperate with the other teams? Because this is like a Monopoly board kind of simulation where you're trying to have land up as the company that's most valuable or able to sell for the highest price at the end of the day. And in 3 days, you can quickly go through many, almost a decade of iterations from real life scenarios and how it changes as your business grows and how you have to make decisions with very little information, how you have to make decisions very fast, how you have to choose between so many different options and you've got so many things going on. And you have to trust your team to make decisions because there's not enough time to have big chit-chats about each decision. And so this is a lot of fun, a lot of frustration, very competitive. And folks who've done it have found it's made it a lot easier to go to market to understand what investors want and why they want it and how to do a better deal.
Neat. It gives them some interesting insights of what they're going to experience ahead. And as another of my colleagues does, he calls it stress inoculation training in some cases, because you're previewing what some of the challenges that you're going to go through. And then when you actually go through them, you'll feel at least slightly less anxious and a little bit more confident in your abilities. So thank you for that. And we'll certainly share your contact information in a moment. Now, because we're the Accelerating Operational Performance podcast, I'm interested in any insights that you have in the operations side of some of the companies that you've worked with and some of the, either contrasting things that the more successful companies did operationally versus the less. And, of course, we're chock-a-block with toolboxes full of tools and distractions and things that companies embrace to try to get operational efficiency, only to be sort of disappointed with the ultimate results. So any insights you can share on companies that are operationally quite effective?
Yes, so I served as an interim president of three companies during my turnaround years. So you're going into a company in an industry you don't know. You're in a very short time frame to save a company. And so you have to figure out, what are we going to do? And so the first challenge is, what are we going to not do, right? And so often when I come into a company where they're having growth problems, they have spread themselves too thin. They have too many different products or too many different divisions, and reluctant to cut because it was such a challenge to launch and get going and what have you. And so part of that is, what's the absolute core that we need to get going? And this kind of pruning, it happens in nature. You prune your trees for growing fruits or what have you, you know. But most companies, after they've had a growth spurt, don't think about pruning and don't see the value of pruning. The other piece that was very interesting for me was the perception of a lot of business owners that every job is pretty much 80% routine. We just need to cookie cutter it like McDonald's. But more and more in companies, a lot of the staff you have are actually doing projects. And you manage projects very differently than you manage routine work. And in fact, more of the routine work is the work you can outsource, and more of the project work is what you need to keep in-house, because the project work changes so much. And being ruthless with projects, having very short time frames. If we don't get results in 3 weeks, not going to the next phase, breaking things into little sprints to get breakthroughs, being able to break things into bite-sized chunks, also having tremendous clarity for everybody what the end game is. I helped, if I give an example, a company that was, in this particular case, I wasn't the interim president. I was the sort of co-pilot to the president. This was a pharmaceutical company, and they sold to pharmacists a whole lot of, you know, various multivitamins and all those kinds of products. And when I came on board, the business was losing $12 million a year on a $60 million of revenue. And head office in Europe was going to close them down if they didn't do something fairly quickly. And so my colleague said, we need a plan, and we need it quick. And the first thing we realized is that they were so focused on what the end customer wanted in terms of multivitamins. And we turned around, we said, we don't care about the end customer. We only care about the pharmacist who is buying these drugs from you and these things. And what's their biggest problem? They want return on investment. And after a whole bunch of homework, everything was about return on investment from every pill we make or distribute. And employees could make any argument they want, get in any meeting with the boss, if they could make a return on investment argument. That galvanized the business. And we got that as the starting block on that little one page. And for 6 years, they ran with that one page. So here was an example of you know, galvanizing folks, irrespective of what silo, irrespective of what department, and you could cut across if you had a good argument to help the overall goal.
Excellent, excellent advice. And that's an example where just the strategy of being ROI focused and focusing on the pharmacist was the key, really the key approach and strategy that got everyone on the same page and made the business successful. So I appreciate you sharing that. I'm wondering, Stuart, what advice would you give to someone who is earlier in their career, you know, but ultimately striving to be successful? What kinds of things do you pontificate about that you'd say, if someone wanted my advice, this is what I would tell them? Because not everyone wants advice. But if they did, what advice would you give somebody as they're trying to make their career more fruitful?
So if I could give it to you from a different perspective. So in fast-growing companies, I've found that it's very hard to hire really good talent, superstars. So what do superstars do that nobody else does? And they do a couple of things. So if you can imagine that when you're being recruited for a job, it's typically, think of it as a box, right? You're going to get into the box and you're going to work your way through the box and then get to the top of the box. And then in a few years, you want promotion to the next box. And in the next box, the superstars come in And even though they're coming in at the hired for the box, they actually want to know, what do they have to do to skip all the boxes and be the confidant of the CEO or be the next CEO? And so they're questioning, they're all there thinking. And so they're less worried about what my salary is going to be and what, how fast I could become a shareholder, or a lot of my compensation would be based on my high performance. So they have all the language about, how do I come into your company and either get through the boxes quickly, but preferably jump the boxes? What have I got to do? And most CEOs, if they're candid, will say, well, if you could do A, B, and C, I'll let you jump one box, you know, or two boxes. And it's that kind of confidence to say, I'm ready to give this, you know, the full leap, and tell me what I got to do. And if I do it, you got to write the check.
Well, I think that's good advice in general, which is also recognizing that the more senior leaders in your organization are looking for people who can help them develop a higher level of intelligence about the business and what might work or might not work. And so if you can be that confidant, then you're automatically adding greater value than your current job function. So I think that's excellent advice, and it's stuff we haven't heard before on the podcast. So thank you. I just wanted to let people know that, so first of all, Stuart, thank you so much for being a guest on the podcast. I've always really cherished our relationship and valued your, and I think people can get a sense of that today, which is this sense of common sense wisdom with a very sharp business mind and very approachable, which is why Stuart is so good at gathering intelligence from inside the organization, even from customers. So thank you so much, Stuart, for your time today.
Thank you, Greg. And I would like to mention to your viewers that your insights into super, particularly first line supervisors, you gave me tremendous insights that I've never thanked you for, which really helped when I was working in these companies. So anybody that's having trouble with first line supervision, I mean, Greg was the master. And I know you do a lot more of this since then, but that first time supervisor is a huge leap and a huge problem in many companies. And you do such an amazing job of that. So good on you guys.
I appreciate that. Thank you. So if you're looking to find out more information about Stuart, some of these awesome simulations that he does for high growth companies, first of all, you should know that Morley is spelled M-O-R-L-E-Y. And so you can reach out to Stuart at morleyconsulting.com. You can also look him up on LinkedIn. And I know that he can add value to your company, especially if you're in that situation where you're trying to get a strategic advantage, or you're just trying to make sure that you don't make the same missteps that cause other people to fall into traps, and you can stay on the path to success. Now, of course, what we'd welcome is if you want more information about the services that we provide to operational companies in terms of first-line supervisors, middle managers, and yes, even a new plant manager development program, you can reach out to us and have a conversation at uniquedevelopment.com. For now, I'll just say thanks for watching the podcast, and we wish you all the greatest success.